do some training for judicial officers and court staff. He's held provided 660 hours of forensic sexual assault and domestic violence exams. This is one of the ways we know that sexual assault does not seem to be decreasing because their numbers are going up each year for the number of hours we're spending on exams. And then we have a, we did a qualitative report where we reached out and talked to survivors throughout the county about what healing and justice meant to them and got some feedback on that, and a little bit I'll share some of the updates that to us. So, this is some data on domestic violence calls for service to Blaine Police Department. So one of the things that stands out about this is, like many places, we saw some decreases, although the decrease in Blaine were a little before 2020, but they weren't really extreme decreases. So Blaine apparently is still getting calls for service during some kind of the lockdown and COVID pandemics, which is a good thing. I think a lot of people were not calling for help during that time. The other thing is that about half of these calls for service throughout the years do not result in arrest, and that usually means it could be that there was no physical assault. It could be also that physical assault didn't occur within the last 4 hours. It could be that the person is no longer on the scene. There's no probable cause. So there's a number of reasons. This is not like time law enforcement showed up and decided, you know, not to make an arrest. It's not meeting the legal definition. And one of the reasons this stands out is just about how often people are calling for help. An arrest is not the answer, and someone can't be arrested or prosecuted, at least at that time. Sometimes there can be an arrest later, but just a lot of the duty then for people who are showing up at the home is to connect people to services, to let them know a little bit about what support there is out there. You know, they let victims know about DBSAS, and that can be like a really, like, big challenge when there's not a specific action or sometimes people are looking for. So people are calling, and then the other half of the time arrest is. Sexual assault, like I said, there's really low numbers in Blaine, and so it's really hard to identify trends when you're talking about a maximum of 6 reports. I would say a year with zero would be concerning because there's definitely sexual assault happening in Blaine, so you don't want a zero ever. But again, one of the things is a better relationship that we can build, and that's all the agencies, the more that we can help people identify what is sexual assault and what are your resources, the more that people can come forward. So again, that's something that we really want to be working with lots of agencies, work with schools and faith communities and workplaces can help people understand what these issues are and when they can work. So why does this matter? So this is, some people I know like to look at numbers and charts, and some people really are more moved by what survivors are sharing with us directly. And so we did that survivor interviews, which we did last year, some of the things that they told us about why it matters. I want to share with you about what the impact is for them. And again, these are people who live throughout Walker County, and I'm sure the experiences of people in this community. So some of the things they said to us is, it's been interesting the amount of people who respond by being concerned about him and what happened to his reputation. It's interesting to have me share what happened that was hurtful, and they focus on the hypothetical hurt this other person might experience. I reported his suicidal text to a counselor. She told me not to break up with him right away, even though he assaulted me. After experiencing child sexual abuse, I did have a therapist at first who asked me what I was wearing when things happened, and if I'd given him the idea that it was okay. Healing would be being able to have therapy and support as long as you need it, and not just as long as you can afford it. And the judge granted more time in the restraining order hearing because the lawyer and my son's dad were unprepared, and that wasn't my fault. And then we had one person, those were just a selection of, we talked to over 40 people for about an hour each. Those are just a selection of things people shared. But one person said something that really talked about, we definitely want to have these interviews, but we do want more than that. We want, obviously, healthy, caring relationships in our community. And they said, healing looks like being believed and supported by my community, being able to walk around town, go to the store, go to the park, living without hypervigilance, being able to wear my hair down again, wearing clothing that makes me happy, being able to experience joy with my friends. And really, when our commission comes together and we're thinking about what we're trying to do, we're really aiming for that, for people, not just the absence of fear or harm, but the presence of real safety and comfort in people's communities. So we have a number of projects we're working on in which we're doing that systems coordination to address these issues. I'm just going to talk about a couple of them today to give you a sense of some of the things we're working on. One of them is our restorative justice project, which we've been working on about 5 years now. We're working closely with the Whatcom Dispute Resolution Center. This is one of the areas that we're actually writing a grant for. It was like a week and a half, so that's what I was doing most of the day, but the Department of Justice is putting out They're going to fund 15 sites around the country to implement restorative justice for domestic violence and sexual assault. And we have been, you know, building towards this. So we're hoping to be one of those pilot sites. And again, that's because, one, so much of what happens in domestic violence is illegal. Some of those consequences don't last forever. People don't stay in jail forever, even if they're charged and acquitted and guilty. Certain protection orders don't last forever. Some people have long-term contact with someone, say, kids in college, so restorative justice can be a way maybe to set some parameters around that so people choose to follow their parenting plan, for example. Also, some people choose not to report. Some people, the reporting process can be really long and want to have a different process. So we are working on bringing some. There are a number of people who are doing this either individually or in a very small scale within organizations. And one of the things we want to do is bring restorative justice program under the umbrella of Dispute Resolution Center within consultation with our commission and DDSAS to provide advocacy for all survivors. So hoping to get that funding, but in the meantime, we have heard from survivors, we've done some training in the community, we have an implementation roadmap, and right now we're going through a toolkit to pull out all the tools that we would need to start a program. We also did intimate partner violence case review, so this is one we'll look at. Last year we looked at 3 intimate partner homicides, and so we try to get a deep dive to learn as much as we can about what is happening with domestic violence in our community. One of the things that happens with a homicide is there's an extremely in-depth investigation, and so we get access to that public record. We can learn a lot from family and friends, co-workers, all the different people that are interviewed about what's happening in that relationship. And the couple of things that we learned that were really stood out to people is one, how often people are going to more natural resources in their community, the places they already are. So people are going to their faith communities, their schools, their healthcare providers, their workplaces, and that's where some of it is showing up. So that need to really prepare all of those people to respond if someone comes forward and reports. We also found that so many kids are being affected. I think that really struck all of us. There was, in each of the cases, there were children involved. There was one case where the man had multiple previous partners and children with all of them. So these kids have parents in jail, parents who died, they've witnessed abuse, one child got killed. There's all these huge impacts, and we don't have a really great coordinated response for that early intervention and wraparound early intervention. And so that's an area where we want to do more work as a community. And then we just learned that people really don't understand domestic violence, that people would say, well, that person knows she can be a victim. She's really smart. Or that guy, no, he's too nice, he couldn't be an offender. People just weren't even imagining what could be happening to people, even though they know something was wrong. And we're actually, one of the things we're going to do this fall is look at the same process with sexual assault protection orders, which again is looking at flyers that may be being applied for granted in this county. And then the third project we're working on is the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and people. And every single Native woman who's ever served on our commission has asked us to really take leadership on this. So last year we spent some time learning more about the topic. Representative Deborah LeCanoff came to our commission meetings and taught us about the history, what the state is doing. Our state has a task force under the Attorney General's office, which is putting out recommendations to address this issue, both response and prevention. And we are going to host a summit, which I'll put the information up in a moment, in November, which will bring together our community leaders to learn more about what's happening locally and implement some of those recommendations locally. And then we just are available for basically any discipline where survivors, children, offenders might be, which is like everywhere, to get feedback from survivors, to get tools in place, or find tools from other organizations, to be able to help agencies when they reach out. And sometimes that's reactively, something has happened in our workplace and we don't know what our policy is. And so, or we train all of our HR managers so they know how to respond to the situation. And sometimes people are kind of doing some of that work proactively and thinking about how do we prepare our students, for example, which is inevitably going to happen, students are going to disclose. And then, like I said, we're having a summit that I hope all of you will be able to attend. It's to learn and take action about violence against Native families. We'll have survivors sharing some of their stories. We'll have some different breakout sessions specific to the legal system, healthcare system, educational system, and community services. We'll hear from people about what is the best way to respond, how the correct resources we refer to. We'll have some time for, learning about just the scope of the problem from some leaders in this field. So it'll be a full day on Wednesday the 20th. And this is really a way, I feel like I go to a lot of meetings where we do the tribal land acknowledgments, which are important to think about where we are. And it's moving from thinking about the land to what is the impact on, especially women who live on this land, and what is the impact on them? How can we make that different moving forward? So, we'll be able to attend. I can see the dates already put out, invitations will go out later this summer from the registration fees. Anyone has any questions or comments?
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for us?
Yeah, a couple of questions. And it's maybe kind of in the weeds, but it's not a very high percentage of women we're able to get protection orders, right? It was like a maybe a third and even less than that could be a full order. What is the major holdup, and how can we kind of work through that in an easier way? So
yeah, there's a couple of things. So one is our county. It seems to be lower than most counties in granting those final orders. So there is something about how we're approaching that, I think, on the judicial level, and actually we've had a huge judicial turnover in the last 5 years, and a lot of the new judges are actually asking for training and wanting to learn more, and so I think that will make a huge shift in how we respond. Also, they are not, like I said, not super accessible, so one of the things we've been trying to get, which if we get that grant, we've been able to put an advocate on site courthouse to help people go through. People drop out for all sorts of reasons. You can show up at the courthouse, get your paperwork, and they'll say, well, go down to DVSAS, which is 3 blocks away, sounds close. If you took the bus in from Lane, and then you got your 2 kids with you, and you're like trying to get somewhere, to your job on time, that 3 blocks and it's raining, like that feels like forever. So just trying to reduce some of those barriers. And then language access is also a huge barrier. And again, one of these that grant do is provide more interpretation for people. Courts provide interpreters for hearings, but no one provides interpreters for them to fill out the paperwork. And you have to turn in the paperwork in English, so it's kind of a complicated process to do in not your primary language. So those are some of the things that I think could help with that problem.
But it sounds like you guys are working on trying to smooth that out.
Yes. And I will also say we have really dedicated staff at the district courts who are doing kind of piecemeal things, and one of the things we're really hoping, the reason we want funding is to do it really comprehensively. Instead of like we get together every quarter and everyone was used with the task to do things to try to do things incrementally better, we really like to.
And the other question I had, or kind of an observation, and I'm not well versed on this, so I'm hoping I don't get quoted on this, but I in my personal and professional life have come into contact with some NOOCSAC individuals, a lot of which are getting evicted from their homes. There's like an internal NOOCSAC thing going on, and a lot of them are single mothers, domestic violence survivors. And is there something that we as a county is able to do because that's tribal land? So I'm sure it's on the radar, but what do we do about something like that?
I think it's like a microcosm of just the housing issue and being without housing. It certainly can be a result of domestic violence, also make people extremely vulnerable to moving in with someone who isn't safe, their children with someone who isn't safe. So I feel like it fits within this larger bucket of as much safe, affordable housing as we can have, knowing that people are going to get displaced for certain reasons. Sometimes it's going to be fleeing domestic violence specifically. Sometimes it'll be, a tribe doing something differently with their land. Sometimes it might be the flooding displaced a lot of people. So there are events that happen there to displace people. And the only way that we can really keep people safe is by having that safe, affordable housing really available and moving towards that, which I know is a whole other issue that we are struggling to solve, county-wide, but it's just such a huge prevention piece is. And being able to keep people employed and having good child care is usually a big part of that. So afford housing, you can have a job, right? So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One thing that stood out to me was you mentioned the reports of sexual assault to law enforcement continues to fall, but that is not what Peace Health and the nurses at Peace Health see. Why do you think that is?
Great question. We're seeing at Peace Health and then also at places like DVSAS, we're getting more people coming for services as well. So, and also you can't compare apples and oranges, they're like different, completely different systems. And I think one is definitely, I think people are aware of social media, the more that people are connected, the more people can be aware of what it is like to actually report if you go through a process where you talk to, if you want to talk to the detective right away and not talk to multiple law enforcement people, but then you've got a gap between their doing an investigation and then it's more to a prosecutor's office and you wait in the prosecutor's office, and then they'll talk to you, and then they make a decision. It's just about, and if they decide to prosecute, you can wait a very long time for a trial. And so I think some of these things, like they don't get resolved, usually for 2 to 3 years if they get resolved in the court system. And so I think that knowledge is more widely available. I think that can be part of why people aren't going. It's just not being sure they want to walk into that system. And so I think that's actually one of the reasons why having an advocate is so important is if someone's run a report, I am certainly not going to make someone report. And if someone wants that option, I think we should make it easy and accessible for people. It's possible having an advocate go with you through that is really the best way to make that, to really just stay informed and to be able to go through that. In addition to all the things that we've been doing, our state requires trauma-informed interviewing training for all of our detectives who work on sexual assault, so that makes a difference. Our prosecutors have recently gone through trauma-informed prosecution training, so we're doing all those pieces, but there's some things that are systemic that we don't have a lot of control over.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a short recess before our scheduled 6 p.m. meeting.